I'd now like to welcome someone who's been central, been a cornerstone of the Stop the War Coalition, the anti-war movement from the very word go, George Galloway.
Thank you very much, Chair, Lindsay, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, assalamu alaikum. I congratulate the Stop the War Coalition on the organizing of this wonderful event. Anyone who was at this session this afternoon will long remember it, maybe always remember it. The historic leadership of the left and progressive movement here in our country, making important contributions, are not things that should be or will be forgotten. I remember the time in the very early 1980s when I was an aide-de-camp to Mr. Benn, our president, picking up the late Fenner Brockway at the Waverley Station in Edinburgh off the overnight train. At 6 a.m, we ascended the steep stairs. Mr. Brockway was, or Lord Brockway as he was then, by then well into his 80s, and as we reached Princes Street, he took a deep breath and he said, "Ah, the first time I spoke in Edinburgh was against the First World War in 1916. Mr. Benn addressed the great rallies in Trafalgar Square against the British, French and Israeli invasion of Egypt in 1956, and his clarion call and arguments then were as crystal clear and powerful as they are today. Mr. Benn, as a young boy, sat on the knee of Mr. Gandhi, one of the leaders of the freedom struggle in India. My daughter, now a mother of three, when she was a baby, sat on the knee of Mr. Benn in my house in Dundee in Scotland. We are a great unbroken line of progress, fighting, marching, struggling, always forward, backwards, never, and we should be proud of Tony Benn and the other historic leaders. I first marched behind Tariq Ali when I was 14, and he was the leader of the demonstration outside the American Embassy in Grosvenor Square against the barbarism of the United States against the people of Vietnam at a time when they were dropping an ocean of chemical weapons upon the people of that country and subsequently of Cambodia as well. I was 14, he was the leader, and now he looks younger than me. You see, the company we keep will keep us young and vibrant. And it was so mesmerizing to hear him again today and still so vital. But even more important than the speeches of us older leaders was the contribution that we just heard from that young woman, the poet, who made me shed a tear and who made my heart beat faster, not just because of the extraordinary power of what she was saying and the clarity with which she was saying it, because it told me, as I hope it told you, that when we older leaders shuffle off this mortal coil, this great progressive army will march on under new young leaders until we are victorious. She, low key and Jody McIntyre and all these young leaders now forcing their way. They have to force their way because older leaders don't easily make way for newer leaders. But they are increasingly appearing on our front line. And I, for one, am very proud, Lindsay, of the work which you and Andrew have led this last decade. It's true, we were 10 years younger then, but we are wiser than that. Now, it is, I think, something to be proud of that we were there, that we stood up when our own country became involved in yet another grisly, bloody, imperialist crime. And we will stay with it as long as God gives us breath and until we are victorious. I was reading the other day a compilation of the parliamentary sketches of a very great sketch writer, now deceased, called Frank Johnson. His wife compiled those sketches that best showcased his work. I feature in two or three of them. He always had a soft spot for my speeches in Parliament. In one of them, two of them actually, he describes an exchange between me and Jack Straw, that friend of liberty. He doesn't want us to see the MI5 file on him, but it might not be for the reasons that you think. Jack Straw actually said, you must get a prize for stupidity. Jack Straw actually said in this exchange with me in early 2002 that the British armed forces were expected to be home by Christmas. Now, you'd think anyone who'd ever read a history book would know that these are precisely the words to be avoided, especially when I'm around. So I rose and through the chair, through the speaker, advised the Right Honourable Gentleman that our forces would not be home for Christmas and not be home for Christmas 10 Christmases hence. And he laughed, and all his acolytes laughed too. Oh, how they laughed. But of course, it won't be long before we will have been sending our young men to give their life's blood for 10 long years, 10 Christmases spent on the front line of this lunatic war, which, as Tariq said, they are now desperate to conclude and will conclude on exactly the terms on which they could have concluded it 10 long bloody years ago. Trillions of dollars ago, thousands of lives ago, just as we predicted. And of course, events unexpected, at least in their timing, have now burst forth onto the political agenda, onto the political horizon, some of which, as has been said by my friends, pose us difficulties which we have surmounted easily in a way which I am also very proud of. You see, it's easy to be in favor of a revolution which overthrows Hosni Mubarak, who in their right mind, even Hillary, Barack, the Peace Prize winner, even they're claiming they were in favor of the revolution against Hosni Mubarak. They think we don't have Sky Plus. They think we don't have the ability to work the internet and to read what they were saying almost until the hour that the dictator fell. But it's much more difficult when the drums are beating and the tinny bugle of patriotism is sounding, when the demonization of the foe crescendos, when Mr. Ben was speaking in Trafalgar Square in 1956 against the British invasion of Egypt, Anthony Eden, the British Prime Minister, was speaking in the House of Commons, and I quote directly, he asked, "Who will rid us of the mad dog of Cairo?" The mad dog of Cairo was Jamal Abdel Nasser, one of the greatest men of the 20th century. And there's been a whole parade of mad dogs ever since. Some of them, admittedly, madder and more canine than General Nasser. But when the propaganda pumps the grotesque, no doubt, figure and regime of Muammar al-Gaddafi and invites us to support our own country becoming an empire again, it took wisdom and courage for all of us to say no. And we must have that same wisdom and courage in the challenges that lie ahead. Those of us who've been across this course can smell what's in the air about Syria. We've been here before. We know that this is the softening up period where the dictator is built up, portrayed as some kind of new Hitler, as they all seem to be. And then the question is, well, what are we going to do about the near civil war which now exists in Syria? I'll tell you what we have to do. We have to condemn the Syrian regime's brutality against those genuine seekers of freedom and liberty in Syria. But we have to condemn and refuse any idea that the way to solve this crisis is for the imperialist countries of America and Britain and France to intervene in the internal affairs of Syria. The BBC, the Bush and Blair Corporation, breathlessly informed us yesterday that the Syrian regime was using Apache helicopters, helicopter gunships, against its own people. I've always been puzzled by this one, Chris, why it's inherently worse to use attack helicopters against your own people than it is to use Apache helicopters against other people's people. I've never quite understood why one is worse than the other. But the same BBC, which could hardly contain its contempt and hatred for the Syrian regime's use of its attack helicopters, was positively cheerleading British Apache helicopters bringing death and destruction to the people of Libya just a week or 10 days ago. The hypocrisy of these people knows absolutely no bounds. But we have to be clear. The Syrian regime is a dictatorship, no doubt, but it's not the same kind of dictatorship as Mubarak and the others. The reason that Israel and America and France and Britain are desperate to bring down the regime in Damascus is not because of their record on civil liberties. If it was, we'd be up in arms about our best friends, Saudi Arabia and many other dictatorships in the same region. No, it's not for that reason at all. It's not because Syria is a dictatorship that we hate it so. It's because the Syrian regime continues to to harbour and support the leadership of the Palestinian resistance in Damascus, that the Syrian regime continues to insist on the return of its territory stolen by Israel in 1967 and refuses to sign a surrender peace with Israel like the other Arab frontline states. It's because the Syrian regime supports the Lebanese national resistance that we all marched in support of when Israel attacked it in Lebanon in 2006. It's because the Syrian regime refused to allow its country to become an armed camp for imperialism to invade and occupy Iraq. So it's not for the bad things about Bashar that they are hoping to bring the regime down, and bad things there are and have gotten worse over these last few months. It's because the Syrian regime is not a slave. You see, we don't mind dictatorships as long as those dictatorships follow the orders of the imperialist countries. So we are clear here in the leadership of Stop the War. I'm sure these young leaders that are coming through are equally clear, and you as our key supporters and organizers, clear also. I came here with just one announcement to make, or one plea for an announcement to make. It's one of the downsides of being the last speaker, that it's already been announced. I speak as the one who got scolded by Lindsay for being the first person to predict that we were going to have 1 million people on our demonstration on February 15th, 2003. I say to the authorities again, we're fed up marching from A to B. Now we're going to occupy public space in London until these wars are at an end. Wassalamu alaikum. Thank you very much.